From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As you know by now, last week, President Joe Biden announced a long-awaited plan for reducing student loan debt. It meets a campaign promise and overcomes his own reported doubts about his power to carry out the plan the way he's aiming to do so. The Department of Education will provide up to $10,000 in relief for most borrowers and up to $20,000 for those who got Pell Grants, which go to people with lower income levels. The money will be available to anyone earning up to $125,000 a year for single borrowers and $250,000 for married couples. Meanwhile, the pandemic pause on loan repayment was extended through the end of the year. What does this decision mean for the roughly 45 million Americans saddled with $1.6 trillion in outstanding student loan debt? Members of Illinois Public Media's Student Newsroom, Noor Longhi and Hannah Lonergan, put a version of that question to their classmates at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign.
Financially, I guess it's a question how they're going to actually balance the books. I guess if you just look at it purely from a student's perspective, it's very good. Mm-hmm. It saves them money. So
hopefully well in terms of like the debt that comes with loans and having that being paid off or not to have that be a worrisome like right now or even like in the future would be very nice.
That was Jun Ryu and Ruchi Patel. And before we begin, I want to acknowledge there are a thousand ways we could have talked about the debt plan on our program, many of which are in fact taking place today on other public radio shows like 1A and Here and Now and in countless other media outlets. There are questions of fairness, reach, and legality. There's talk of the courts looking favorably on attempts to block Biden's plan. There's been anger. There's been joy. But since our show is only 1 hour, we're going to focus our conversation and talk about how student loan debt forgiveness can be seen through the lens of racial and gender justice. For that, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, associate professor at Loyola University Chicago's History Department and the author of Indentured Students: How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in Student Debt. Elizabeth, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us is Dr. Janice Gassamasare, a racial equity consultant and writer, and her article, Why Student Loan Debt Cancellation is a Racial Justice Issue, appeared on Forbes.com earlier this month. Janice, thank you for joining us as well, and welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited about this conversation.
And finally, we are also welcoming Amy Schneider back to the 21st Show. Amy's a Chicago area organizer and debt striker with Debt Collective, a debtors union pursuing complete student loan debt cancellation. Amy, thanks for coming back. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me again. Happy to be here and have this conversation with you guys today.
And listeners, I want to invite you to join us as well. 800-222-9455 is the number to call. What do you think of the president's plan to forgive $10,000 to $20,000 in student loan debt for most borrowers? Is this something that you yourself have been hoping for? Or maybe you're on the side of people who say, I don't know if this is a good idea for the best use of federal money. Whatever it is, let us know. 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or tweet us at 21st Show. So, Elizabeth, I want to begin with you and start out with some context for our listeners. In your book, I mentioned Indentured Students. You talk about the federal student loan program. It was never really intended to make college affordable. Say more about that.
Oh, sure. And it's one of the things that if we're talking about the first major loan program, which is the Guaranteed Student Loan Program, that's seemingly buried in the 1965 Higher Education Act. And I encourage your listeners, if you still have your college textbooks, if you find it in the chapter on the 1960s, it usually talks about a direct federal investment in higher education. Well, it's actually not so true because actually lawmakers in Congress, the Lyndon Baines Johnson presidency or the administration, they all put an emphasis on this guaranteed student loan program. And the intention was, in the midst of trying to fight a war on poverty, in the midst of trying to do a lot of other social programs as a part of the Great Society, and of course, fight a war in Vietnam, the idea was they looked to the federal mortgage program of the 1930s And they were going to create a student loan industry where there actually had not been one. And the idea was this was a way that the United States had not invested in public housing in the 1930s. This would be a way to avoid the kind of really direct federal investment to keep college costs down and affordable, and instead encourage an industry just like that original mortgage program created a mortgage industry where there really hadn't been one. And of course, we know now, decades later, just how much that mortgage industry has exacerbated racial and gender inequities, just like the student loan program has actually done as well. And I think for me, what happened in the wake of that decision to really focus on this loan program was a sort of doubling down on we're going to lend, this idea that college shouldn't be free, that that was un-American somehow to have tuition-free college, even though they had it in California at the time in the public systems. And even when they laid out that now beloved, but that was controversial at the time, Pell Grant program in 1972, even Senator Claiborne Pell expected Pell recipients to have to borrow to pay for their education. And I think for me, what was really challenging about writing this book is actually kind of heartbreaking. That how college was actually not affordable for the majority of Americans. Before he was assassinated, JFK warned against putting an emphasis on lending, noting that even in 1962, the average cost of college at the time was more than half of median income. So when you look at that number, about $5,000 a year in 1962, well, goodness, the average median income in the United States at the time was $7,000. And I think it just goes to that college has always been hard to pay for. And that we finally have people no longer hiding how much debt they were incurring for college, how hard it was to pay, but speaking out. And it is their activism and hard work that actually pushed the Biden administration to offer some relief.
Janice Guess, I'm sorry, I want to bring you into the conversation now, and your work focuses on racial equity. So can you respond to what Elizabeth was saying there and this idea of, you know, if college is not going to be free for everyone, who does, you know, quote unquote, deserve higher education, and who's responsible for paying for it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I was thrilled to hear the news about some debt relief, because I think that the price for school is so exorbitant and it just keeps rising. But an interesting part of the conversation is that, you know, $125,000 or $250,000 is not the same for Black families and white families. And so I think that we have to be centering part of the conversation in this idea of reparations for Black Americans and what that could look like. And, you know, I've written about this before, and I think that part of what reparations could look like is determining, you know, what universities benefited from slave labor, which is virtually every elite institution in this country, and allowing Black students specifically to go to school for free. And so, you know, I think that the median wealth for Black families in 2019 was about $41,000. And for white families, it was $74,000. So we have to recognize that there has been hundreds of years of historic marginalization, which has contributed to this divide. And so I think that it is nice that there will be some relief, but we also have to discuss how, you know, money is just not the same for Black families versus white families.
Well, yeah, say more about that. Why is it that education debt then disproportionately affects or burdens Black and brown borrowers, especially Black women?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we all know, owning a home is the primary driver of wealth in this country. So the way that many of us are able to accumulate wealth and pass on generational wealth is through home ownership. And for many millennials, period, it's just completely unfeasible for us to own homes because we're saddled with six-figure student loan debt. You know, and what we're paying for student loan debt, or what we were paying prior to the pause, was more than what many people are paying for their mortgage, right? So it's just not feasible. And with rent prices going up, you know, it's just, it disproportionately impacts Black women, who are also the most educated race and demographic in this country. So, you know, also for Black people, there's something called the Black tax. And when we make money or we get a paycheck, that money has to go to our family. That money has to go to our, you know, extended family. For those of us who are from different countries, many of us are sending money back to family members who are in different parts of the world, right? So I think that we don't really open up this conversation about the ways that our family structures are different and the ways that a lot of the strain is happening to Black families and different communities around the country.
Amy Schneider with the Debt Collective, I want to ask you, can you take us, this is something you've been working on for a long time, obviously, take us back to the moment you learned the details of President Biden's plan. I guess, what was it, last week? You know, where were you? What were you doing? What was your reaction?
So I was actually at home. I found out, and my reaction was, it was kind of a complex sort of reaction, because on the one hand, I'm very excited that there's any, you know, student debt cancellation. When I started this, people said it was pie in the sky, it would never happen, and now it's up to $20,000 for people with Pell Grants. But it doesn't go far enough. That was the other thought, was, well, this is great, it shows that it can be done. But it definitely doesn't go far enough. You know, we have so many people out there that have six figures of student loan debt. $10,000 or $20,000 is going to be almost nothing. It's going to be a drop in the hat. And the way with the way that interest rates compound on these student loans, they're going to be back in the same exact place in no time at all. So it's really, it doesn't help people that have, you know, more than that amount of debt. There are people that are going to have all of their debt wiped out, and that's fantastic for them. But then there's the other people that are, you know, going to be stuck with just this compounding interest on this debt, you know, paying off, you know, mortgage rate student loan payments, and it's getting them nowhere. You know, I know people that have paid, you know, $97,000 on $98,000 worth of loans, and they still somehow owe like $91,000. How do you ever get out of a debt like that? You know, $10,000, $20,000 of debt cancellation for them, it's going to do a little bit for a very short amount of time, but then that debt's going to come right back. So I'm excited because it definitely sets the precedent now that it can be done. It proves what we've been saying, that provision was placed in the Higher Education Act of 1965. So that's like a huge win for activists, especially given that, you know, no one wanted to even talk about this a couple of years ago. But I think that we still have a lot of work to do to get where we need to be.
Loyola University historian Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, what do you think about that? Does President Biden's plan go far enough?
I don't think it does, and especially for all the wonderful reasons that Amy Schneider just sort of laid out as well. And I think what I do admire about it, it actually speaks to what Janice was actually mentioning in her relief, that it actually sort of notices that this has actually had a disproportionate effect on low-income families who still remain more likely to be families of color. And I always tell people to take a look at how different the president's discussion of student debt was from his very first town hall very early in his presidency. I believe it was February or January of 2021. And when he was asked, he said, oh, it depends on if it's, you know, if you went to Harvard or Yale, just some offhanded remark. And that was very different from that press conference, which really understood that there is debt being incurred for community colleges, for trade schools, a actual recognition that there is racial and gender inequity built into these programs, which they have been for the beginning. And I think that that's a step forward. It's also a credit to both the researchers like Janice, as well as the activists like Amy, to have really started to change the conversation in Washington and the really moderate part of the Democratic Party. And congratulations to them.
Yeah, and we need to take a break in a couple of minutes. But before we do, Janice, I want to ask you about, I mean, if your goal is to tackle racial and gender disparities using the power of the federal government, is forgiving the debt of college graduates and former college students the best use of federal money? I mean, people have a lot of medical debt and other sort of debt that they're burdened with.
Yeah, I do, because my question is always, who is the most disproportionately impacted by our policies, our laws, and our practices? And just knowing the history of this country and looking at the ways that different groups have been historically marginalized, I think we have to think about and look at, you know, what is preventing different communities from succeeding or advancing financially? And why is it that there is this huge racial wealth gap? And I think the fact that many people were unable to own property, and, you know, we peel back the layers and say, well, why don't they own property? Why are they unable to? And so many millennials, Gen Xers are saddled with six-figure student loan debt. So I think that really looking at the ways that this debt has impacted all aspects of people's lives, I do believe that student loan debt cancellation will have the biggest impact on borrowers.
All right, listeners, we want to hear from you at 800-222-9455. What do you think of President Biden's student loan debt plan? Again, he's, as you know by now, forgiving $10,000 for most borrowers, $20,000 if someone was a Pell Grant recipient, lower income level to qualify for those. And this applies to anyone, individuals earning up to $125,000 a year or $250,000 a year in income for couples. What do you think of this? Has outstanding student loan debt affected your life? And what would loan forgiveness do for you? We'd love to hear from you at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to continue our conversation with Elizabeth Tandy Shermer of Loyola, Janice Gassam Asare, and Amy Schneider when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. If you're just joining us, we are talking about President Biden's plan to forgive $10,000 to $20,000 of student loan debt. We're speaking about this with Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, an associate professor in the Department of History at Loyola University Chicago, and the author of the book Indentured Students: How Government Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in Student Debt. We're also talking about this with Janice Gassam Asare, a racial equity consultant and writer. And her article is Why Student Loan Debt Cancellation is a Racial Justice Issue. It was published recently on Forbes.com. And then also with us is Amy Schneider, a Chicago area organizer and debt striker with the Debt Collective, which is a group pursuing complete student loan debt cancellation. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. And we've already heard from some members of our texting group. Brandy in Urbana said, this will cut my student debt down by a little more than a third. My student loans have been a constant cloud over my head. There have been multiple times that I nearly defaulted in my early years of repayment because I didn't understand my repayment plans. I think this move falls short of what was promised, but I'm glad to see Biden doing something. And then Abby in Urbana said, I've been going back and forth since April with Fed loans. I'm backed up at work, can't find the time to be put on hold for 30 to 60 minutes to chat with an agent. I have less than $9,000 left. I'm a teacher that busts her butt every day to meet kids where they're at. I need the government to help me out and forgive the rest of my loans. And if they can give me back anything I paid to Navient, I would be grateful. Amy, I want to ask you, you are somebody who's, I'm sure, spoken with a lot of people burdened with student loan debt over the years. What stood out to you in those comments? And what is it, maybe just broadly speaking, what does it mean to publicly share your experiences with debt?
So I think hinting on the comments that we received, that's like a really common thread that I hear, especially now that only, you know, $20,000 is going to be canceled. I'm in a lot of the Facebook groups for students that are seeking debt cancellation, where people are seeking, you know, camaraderie and just, you know, trying to, you know, come together and organize around this debt. And a big theme is that while this is a great step forward, they're still going to be left with a ton of debt after this. And, you know, they still don't know how they're going to end up paying that, especially with inflation, with what it is, with housing costs, you know, being what they are. Everything, you know, is very intersectional. So when you have these student debts looming over you, you're also not able to pay for other things in your life that you need to pay for, like your bills, you know, your medical costs, your housing, you know, things like this. So the debt does loom large over a lot of people still. It's not a complete, you know, get out of, you know, debt card. It does, and it does fall short of what Biden promised in his campaign. So we really do need to, you know, cancel the rest of it, so people don't have that, you know, looming over their heads, and people can actually have money to spend within their communities, spend, you know, on things that are going to actually do something for their lives rather than just going to investors and banks, which is where it's kind of going now. As far as, you know, what it means for the debt movement moving forward, I think it's a big step forward because it does set the precedent. Right now, it can be done. He was able to use that authority given to him in the Higher Education Act of 1965 to cancel the debt that he has. It's the same debt, the same provision that has allowed the pause to be extended time after time. So really, he just needs to do the right thing and pick up the pen again and cancel the rest of it.
All right, we're getting a number of calls coming in at 800-222-9455. Alan actually had to hang up before we got to him, but he's a college graduate who says he worked two jobs, parents worked jobs to help get him through college, and thought this was an unfair giveaway. We also got an email from Michael in Champaign who asked, how about all the homeless in this country? Wouldn't they like $10,000? But then we also have another perspective from Jim in Springfield, who's on line four and joins us now. Jim, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So what do you think about this plan?
I mean, ultimately, I think it's wonderful. The backstory, I'm very fortunate. I grew up in a different country. I grew up in England, and I was fortunate enough to not have any college debt. I had a public college, so it was free for me, you know, covered by taxes or whatever. My wife went to college in this country, and she was not as fortunate. You know, even with scholarships and working two jobs through college, you know, she still took her the better part of 15 years to pay off her college debt. And finally having that stuff on her shoulders is nice, obviously a nice thing to do. I think a lot of the problem, too, with what I've read online is there's almost this kind of American exceptionalist idea that, you know, especially for lower and middle class families, you need to go to college. You need to go to college and make something of yourself. But there's absolutely no concept of what that's going to cost you. So people are almost pressured. Like peer pressure to go to college, as many really should, honestly. But you know, and a lot of the, I guess, political standpoint seems to be that, especially with most Congress being on average age of about 55 to 60 years old, they were in college, would have been practically the price of a McChicken sandwich.
That's the way that's gone up.
It's a significantly different world.
No, it certainly is, Jim. Thank you so much for calling in. Let's ask some of our guests to respond to what we heard there. And maybe, Elizabeth, I don't know if you want to pick up on that last point. I know as somebody who used to cover state government pretty closely as a reporter here in Illinois, I know that the amount of actual real dollars that the state was directing toward operational costs of higher education in, I think it was 2018 or so, was less than 20 years earlier. There's almost no other area of state government, and that's not even adjusting for inflation, where investment has actually gone down over time.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And I think the thing is that as there's been a decline in federal and state funding in higher education, and it was never enough in all state, or with one exception of states, to actually make higher education really affordable, that's absolutely true. And there was a great line from a higher education analyst who said it in the early 2000s, state legislators know that they can cut the higher education revenue and they'll just pass it, they can finance it through loans. And that really comes down to that idea. And I think the thing for me is that thinking about some of the other callers, you know, who called in about what they remember about, they did their jobs, they did their payments. I've also heard from folks who had that and would never want someone else to go through that again. And for me, the only thing that I am really concerned about with cancellation is that it will lose the momentum to actually deal with college costs. And I think it was very sad that the Build Back Better program, which had the provisions for two free years of community college, that it went away, that had the potential to have the cost of college. It also would have put competitive pressure in terms of actually the cost for the other four-year institutions as well. But then, of course, there's the College for All Act that progressives like Bernie Sanders and Representative Powell Oklahoma have been putting into Congress for several years now, which would give you a tuition-free option, which is what we have New Mexico experimenting with right now, but also New York State is also doing something that would really cut the cost of college for those making less than 125K. And because my answer is like, you know, I'd love to cancel all the debt now, but I want to make sure that no one else has to go into debt for what is a basic public good.
Janice, I want to ask you about some of these ideas that this is unfair or a handout. We heard that email from Michael who said, well, you know, wouldn't homeless like $10,000? He actually sent a follow-up message that said, I'm 70 years old, still working to get my kid through college debt-free. I voted for Biden, but I won't again. Maybe that's not pertinent to this part of the conversation, but maybe it is, right? What do you think to these people who say this is unfair? How do you respond to that?
You know, I laugh at that. I actually saw that, I won't name him, but one of my favorite, my former favorite financial pundits had made similar comments recently about how he felt like this was a handout and it was completely unfair to people that quote unquote worked really hard to pay off their student loans. But we don't consider the fact that in this country, a lot of people have been given sort of unfair bailouts in the form of, you know, PPP loan relief, and how many of the people who did receive PPP loans were not business owners of color, right? Those who really needed it during the pandemic did not receive it, and they did not, of course, get bailouts. So we don't talk about that. We don't talk about all of the unfair and unearned privileges that even afforded people the ability to go to college. And it's really mind-blowing when you think about, I've read this book about slave labor in Ivy League institutions. And, you know, the author talked about how, you know, many of these students, Black students, were unable to attend these institutions that were built by their ancestors. And so I think that all of those things are unfair. So if we really want to talk about what is fair and what's unfair, we have to think about that as well, and how we deal with people who have been able to accumulate wealth through unearned privileges and benefits. And so, you know, I think that it, as a country, we pay into a lot of systems and structures that don't benefit every single person, right? As a millennial, I will likely never get to benefit from Social Security, but I pay into it, and it benefits older populations and disabled populations, right? And so I think that we have to be thinking about how, even though this doesn't benefit or may not benefit us directly, what sort of impact it will have on millions and millions and millions of people.
And, you know, this, Elizabeth, I want to ask you about another aspect of this. There has been talk that opponents of the plan might sue and convince the courts to block it. I wonder what you think of that possibility. And I mean, this is, you know, in some ways, this is yet another example of Congress not acting and the administration, you know, trying to take up the slack. This has been happening since the Obama administration on both sides of the aisle, in fact.
Oh, yes, exactly. And I mean, actually, the part of the mess we're in is because the legislature had refused to act and kept doubling down on loans and has not reauthorized the Higher Education Act since its last reauthorization during the Obama era. So to get to your question, so I've heard it. There is a Virginia Law Review article circulating that does not believe that people have the standing to sue. Will that stop people from trying? Probably not, because that is where everything is being fought out these days, because we have a lot of, it's not just Congress, but we have a lot of heavily divided legislatures that makes it very hard to actually, lawmakers to actually do their job, to actually legislate, to get the majorities needed to. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I find the arguments made that there wouldn't be standing to sue, I find that very compelling. Doesn't mean that people aren't going to try, but how they're actually, if they're going to be successful or not, is a different issue.
Yeah, and probably one that we could spend an entire show with legal scholars discussing. So,
exactly.
All right, let me see if I can get in one more caller. Dennis is calling from Eureka on line one. Dennis, thanks for calling in.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm well. What's your question or comment?
Well, my comment is my wife and I are both college graduates. As a matter of fact, she has postgraduate studies. We both use student loans. to pay off our schooling. And in our opinion, it was a great investment. I think that the people are going to get these cancellations, which I don't agree at all. You can't cancel a debt. It doesn't go away. Someone is paying for it. They're not going to get the satisfaction of earning what they got the loan for, which is to get a higher education. And this is not something that we should be passing on to students of any kind, college or high school or grade school, but it's a free ride out there. You can expect someone else to pay for your education. That's not a good idea.
Dennis, just briefly, what do you think of the argument that, you know, when people like you, you said, I think in the late 80s is when you went to college. I went in the 90s. It was a heck of a lot cheaper back then. And so the loans didn't have to be quite as expensive.
You can equate those two issues, but that's not a good idea either. If you want to work on the cost of college, then work on that. Don't work on, and I hate to use the term forgiving, because there's no forgiveness in a debt. It's out there. Someone's paying for it, and that someone is taxpayers. I don't understand what satisfaction someone can get from that.
Well, Dennis, I appreciate you sharing your perspective. Thanks for calling in. And that is a counterpoint to a text we got. Somebody said, I feel like if my tax dollars help one single mother pay off their student loan debt, then I will have accomplished a small part in this society. We're running short on time here. Amy, I wonder, as a member of the activist community, if these legal challenges were, in fact, successful, what do you anticipate would be the reaction to that?
Well, I think that we would continue fighting any other legal way we can. I mean, I really don't see it being successful, honestly. But if it were to be, you know, I think more people will go on strike. We've already had a bunch of successful strikes. We've had billions of dollars in debt cancellation already secured for debt collective members, for for-profit college students that went to, you know, fraudulent for-profit schools. They've had their debt canceled from Corinthian, from ITT Tech. There's a lawsuit right now awaiting approval. It's called Sweet First Cardona, which also secures debt relief. And that was based off of the borrower defense to repayment claim that the debt collective originally had on their website. So I think, you know, no matter what, we're going to keep on fighting because this is what is just. And I just wanted to add one more comment about the people, you know, folks who keep saying who's going to pay for it. You know, a lot of economists, mainstream economists, are against this. You know, I think we'll see with 10 to 20%, or 10 to 20,000 rather, of debt cancellation. If it really does do that, I don't think it will. The Levy study the Levy Institute put out a 10-year macroeconomic effects of student debt cancellation study, which actually showed that it would actually substantially boost the economy to have debt, you know, canceled, because it would free up buying power for people to actually spend that money in their communities, to actually reinvest into things, to start businesses, rather than just paying student loans. You know, I think people need to start questioning who does this debt benefit, and does society really benefit from people being trapped in this debt?
Amy Schneider is an organizer with the Debt Collective. We've also been speaking with Janice Gassam Asare, a racial equity consultant. Her article, Why Student Loan Debt Cancellation is a Racial Justice Issue, it appeared on Forbes.com. We'll have a link to that on our website, 21stshow.org. And we were also joined by Professor Elizabeth Tandy Shermer from Loyola University Chicago. She's also the author of Indentured Students, How Government-Guaranteed Loans Left Generations Drowning in Student Debt. Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, Janice Gassam Asare, and Amy Schneider, thank you so much for being with us to talk about this on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm sure we will continue this conversation looking at other facets of this program in the weeks and months ahead. More to come after a short break. You're listening to the 21st Show. Stay with us.